is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Is there no limit to the pandering and, well, to the functional suckerness of the Republican base? This Jade Helm thing, this is astonishing. And okay, let me back up a little bit. Most people have probably heard the phrase bread and circus, right? Bread and circus was the formula that the Romans used to keep the populace happy. And basically what it meant was keep them entertained and keep them fed. Nobody in Rome was hungry, I don't know if nobody was hungry, but you know they avoided the kind of food riots that they had in France that led to the French Revolution. Let's put it that way. Bread and circus. The Republicans are confronted with a very similar problem. How do you keep people happy when they're fundamentally unhappy? How do you keep people voting for you when their lives are being turned to dirt? I mean, you know, middle class, working class people, they're being ruined. And the Republicans, you know, their mission is tax cuts for the rich and raise taxes, raise fees, make more money off working people and the poor. It's real simple. And, you know, there's just like there's no list. There's no end to it all. I mean, but in the midst of all this, while they're doing this, the challenge that the Republican Party has is how can they avoid having a conversation about anything that Bernie Sanders says? And increasingly that Hillary Clinton says. She just came out yesterday, by the way, with a very strong statement. She would go even farther than President Obama in terms of executive orders on deportations to keep the Dreamers here. And she said, let's keep their families here, too. Which, of course, is going to turn the right wing. I mean, the right wingers are going to go crazy. They always do. But increasingly, so what? So, you know, Bernie Sanders, if you look at the issues, these are the things that the Republicans want to make sure people aren't talking about. He wants to, roll back the Reagan tax cuts. My phrase, not his, but basically raise the top tax rate on very, very wealthy people. Reagan dropped it from 74% down to 25%. And Bernie is like, that's a mistake. Well, we can't have a discussion about that in Republican circles because the average working class Republican might agree with raising taxes on rich people, especially if it means that the bill for their health insurance goes down or that the schools that their kids go to get better. Republicans are not idiots. They're just, in this case, being played for suckers. And this is a very sophisticated operation to do it. You got Fox so-called news. You know, the official voice of the Confederate States of America. You've got hate radio, right-wing hate radio all across this country. You know, heavily funded and subsidized by very large corporations. So, number one, Bernie Sanders wants to raise taxes. Number two, he wants to expand the social safety net to protect the poor. Number three, he wants to have single-payer health care. No more health insurance companies? Stephen J. Hemsley's made over $1 billion running United Healthcare. He's going to have to, like, what, go out of business? No, well, you'd have to scale back. You could become like the health insurance companies in Germany or in Switzerland where, you know, if somebody has so much money that the normal health insurance that the government provides isn't enough, then, you know, they can buy a private, you know, they can buy health insurance that would provide for like a private room or a private wing or whatever it may be. But anyway, so, you know, the health insurance companies could survive. They're just not going to be as big as they are under a Bernie Sanders presidency. He favors breaking up the too big to fail banks. I guess he's not going to get any donations from Jamie Dimon. He favors a $15 an hour minimum wage. He favors stronger support for organized labor, and he favors legalizing pot. By the way, these are all positions of Elizabeth Warren as well. So what are the Republicans doing? Well, to start out with, down south, they're just hyping the fact that, you know, the federal government, I mean, we have military exercises all the time, and we've got a military exercises planned for Texas. Or it's not just Texas. It's actually six states. And they had to pretend, okay, this area is hostile to us, and this area is friendly to us, and this area is I mean, it's just like in real warfare. And Louis Gohmert, well, first of all, here's the guy, arguably the guy who's like just feeding the whole thing, Alex Jones. Here's a clip of what he had to say.
And every time we get footage, they're training to attack and beat and arrest and shoot and kill patriots. This is what a slow motion martial law scenario looks like.
Right. Now, you'll recall that President Obama, when he was running for president the first time in 2008, behind closed doors, he made a comment about conservatives who cling to their religion and their guns. Here's what Louis Gohmert had to say. See, this is all about having, from the right, this is all about saying that the president of the United States is illegitimate. He was an illegitimate child. He is an illegitimate president. He shouldn't be in the White House. This is, you know, how did this happen? How did this black man end up in our White House? So, you know, essentially say people like Louis Gohmert. And here's exactly how he said it. He said, once I observed the map depicting hostile, permissive, and uncertain states and locations, I was rather appalled that the hostile areas amazingly have a Republican majority. Well, we're doing it in the South. Oh, yeah, I forgot. It's the Confederate state. Anyhow, have a Republican majority, cling to their guns and religion, and believe in the sanctity of the United States Constitution. He said such labeling tends to make people who have grown leery of federal government overreach. What overreach are we talking about here? Well, maybe the NSA, but I think he's going someplace else completely different. Who have grown leery of federal government overreach, become suspicious of whether their big brother government anticipates certain states may start another civil war? Is this a city member of the House of Representatives, member of Congress, wondering out loud, well, actually in a written statement, whether the president of the United States is contemplating starting a civil war? Whether their big brother government anticipates certain states may start another civil war or be taken over by radical Islamist elements, which have been reported to be just across our border. Oh, that's right. Obama's a secret Muslim, too. How could we forget? Right? How could we forget? Meanwhile, the press, while the press is all over the Jade Helm thing, they're not pointing out that the Republicans just passed a bill that would cut veterans benefits for 70,000 veterans. I was listening to NPR this morning, and in the car on the way in here, and they were talking about the Republican budget, and they listed a couple of things that it would do, and they never mentioned, you know, the horror show that is the Republican budget. It's astonishing how sanitized the Republican budget gets in the American press. Because the Republic, and there's a reason why. I mean, the richest 1/100th of 1% of Americans gave 42% of political donations back in 2012. Right? So here we are. You got the owner class, the billionaire class. You got the paid show class, the Louis Gohmerts, the politicians, the guys out there whipping up the fear and the terror and, oh my God, look out, it's the government. And then you got the suckers. And the suckers are being brought along. In a whole variety of ways. Like this woman who is suing in Nebraska against all homosexuals. I mean, this is just like this is the Republican variation on bread and circus. Keep them entertained and they won't pay attention to your picking their pockets.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more right after this. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour, and Joyce watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Deer Lodge, Montana. Hey, Joyce, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. And you know the old saying, if at first you don't succeed, try again.
There you go.
I've been trying to get hold of you since last Thursday.
Oh, well, thanks for your persistence.
That's a good sign. That means lots of people are are watching you and listening and want to talk. Anyway, I haven't been on Facebook since it was revealed that NASA was collecting our data. But I'm going to go on Facebook, and I am going to express my opinion about Bernie Sanders and what he believes in, what he stands for, and encourage people to donate, to work for him, whatever. I believe that Bernie can win.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I do, too.
I watched you part of the time. I was out working in my yard yesterday, but I watched it. You were talking about Meet the Press. Mm-hmm. John Boehner be on there.
Yeah.
I taped that program. I watched it a third time this morning. There was not one mention of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, didn't he have Martin O'Malley on, too?
He had, yes, but
Who is an undeclared.
About Bernie.
Right, and
anyway,
Martin.
They talked about Huckabee, and they talked about Carson, and they talked about, what is the gal from California?
Yeah, Carly Fiorina.
Not one mention, because if they
Bernie.
Give minutes of press or of airtime to Bernie Sanders,
yeah,
it will go like wildfire.
Well, that's the problem. They you know, the corporate media in this country know that the vast majority of Americans, I mean, they can look at the polls, the vast majority of Americans don't like the direction this country has been going in since we adopted Reaganism. And,
right.
And you know, Americans are saying enough already. You know, when you've got, you know, 6-8 media companies controlling 90% of everything people read, watch and hear, you know, in the mainstream media, when you've got, you know, 13,000 magazines owned by 12 companies, you've got, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And people are saying enough already. You know, this is not what I want. And you've got the billionaires getting richer and richer, and not just most, but more than 100% of all the benefits, you know, as the economy grows, going to the top 1%, and whereas the bottom 50% are actually collapsing. I mean, it's just, they've got to figure out a way to distract us, and in particular, not have somebody like Bernie pointing out these uncomfortable truths.
Tom,
yeah.
I believe I told you when I talked to you before, I marched in D.C. on Solidarity Day
mm-hmm.
in 1981.
Great.
I believe it was,
good on you.
Okay. And it was the same thing then, and that was when Reagan was president.
Yeah.
Then there were, I would guess, millions of people in that march. And another thing today, they were talking about the, I forget what program it was, they were talking about unions. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been a union member since 15, my age 15, I'm 83 years old. When the Rochester teachers were unionized, it was because the Board of Education would not negotiate
right. Until
they were threatened with a walkout. Well, no walkout, because the Taylor Law is in New York,
right. And
they would be fined for every day they were on strike.
Right.
So what they did, before school started, they collected everybody's union, or not the union, because we didn't have a union, collected everyone's keys.
Right.
And so before school started, the union president, yes.
It's an amazing story. Joyce, I gotta go. But thank you for sharing the story with us. And spot on. I'm with you. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. So just going through the breadth and depth of the suckerdom, right, of all the things that the Republican Party and the conservatives do to distract their base, to whip up their base, to work up their base so that they don't pay attention to the fact that they're being robbed blind. And it's really quite extraordinary. Steve Payne over at Daily Kos is writing a fascinating diary. He says, we've had a good run. We've been together 21 years, 7 of them legally wed. He's talking about his husband and himself. He says, but this is all about to crash and burn around our ears thanks to 66-year-old Sylvia Driscoll of Auburn, Nebraska. According to the Omaha World Herald, this outstanding legal scholar has just filed an extraordinarily powerful lawsuit titled Driscoll v. Homosexuals with the district court in Omaha. She isn't merely suing her local homosexuals. She is suing all homosexuals. He says, Brian and I will be liquidating our assets in preparation for a certain loss. We anticipate the restitution order to this woman will take us down to our very last penny. In the meantime, our fear is so great, we have ceased and desisted being homosexual. Right. It's like, you know, so, yeah, let's talk about anything except how they're picking our pockets. Right? Jade Helm 15 thing. And Greg Abbott, the governor of the state, asked the state, the national, you know, the state guard to monitor the operation so that, quoting Greg Abbott, Texans know that their safety, constitutional rights, property rights, and civil rights will not be infringed. All right, we got to worry about that. You do have that black guy running the military, you know. Even a former Republican lawmaker accused Greg Abbott of, quote, pandering to idiots. This, according to a roundup piece over at TPM. Ron Paul praised Greg Abbott. He says, I'm not at the point where I think this is the first step, and 6 months from now you're going to see martial law around the country. And I sure hope I'm right about that. Right. This is a verbatim quote from a Ron Paul video that was just released. Rand Paul, of course, says he's going to look into this. Ted Cruz says, now, keep in mind, our religious liberty rights, has this administration done anything to harm anybody's religious liberty rights? I don't know of any. Our Second Amendment rights, I mean, Obama has not even pushed for a return to Reagan's assault weapons bill. Right, take war, weapons of war off the table. Obama's done none of this. Our free speech rights? Maybe Cruz is talking about Obama saying he wasn't happy with Citizens United, which equates billionaires spending money to buy politicians with the right of free speech identified in the First Amendment. But in any case, here's what Ted Cruz said, and you can just hear the subtext of who's that guy in the White House coming through here. I think part of the reason is we have seen for 6 years a federal government disrespecting the liberty of the citizens. Really? He says, and that produces fear. No, Ted, what produces fear is a right-wing machine that cranks out constant paranoia and hysteria. That's what produces fear. People like you, Ted Cruz, produce fear. He goes on to say, when you see a federal government that is attacking our free speech rights, our religious liberty rights, our Second Amendment rights, that produces distrust as to the government.
Right.
Chuck Norris. U.S. government says it's just a training exercise, but I'm not sure the term just has any reference to reality when the government uses it.
Right.
I played Alex Jones's clip for you. Rick Perry is like, you know, I think it's okay to question your government. I do it on a pretty regular basis. The military is something else. But then, you know, in other words, he's not going to diss our soldiers, but he sure is going to diss our president. He says, however, it's perfectly legitimate to question the intentions of civilian leadership. It's, you know, that's a fancy way of saying the commander in chief, right? The only civilian who is the leader of the military is Barack Obama. That's it. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, they're all from the military. Every arm, you know, every branch of the military, the armed services has. Wow. So in the meantime, we have, and this should be the lead story in every newscast in America. In March, the last month for which we have numbers, we just finished April, the trade deficit in the United States became $51.4 billion for the month. $1 billion in a trade deficit, some estimate, equals roughly 10,000 jobs. So $51 billion is 51,000 jobs, American jobs that are not here because of that trade deficit. It's also $51 billion that we put into the pockets of companies and governments overseas, and they're going to, you know, when they come back to the United States with that money, they're going to have to spend it here in the United States, which is why one-seventh, as Congressman Grayson pointed out to us last week, one-seventh of all assets in the United States, all the stocks, all the bonds, all the property, all the land, all the commercial land, private land, you name it, mineral rights, mines, power plant, one-seventh of all the assets, obviously it's not evenly distributed among all these different categories, but one-seventh of all the assets in the United States are now foreign-owned. It was not that way when Reagan came into office. How did it get that way? Wild trade deficits ever since the early 1980s. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Got any ideas, suggestions, thoughts on, or examples, actually, I guess is the word I'm looking for other ways that the Republicans are reaching out to their suckers? Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States. Tom Hartman here with you. This is very interesting. I can't tell you what they're saying because I don't have the sound turned on, but I have, you know, we've got a couple of monitors here in the studio, and the one I'm looking at right now is on MSNBC, and they're doing just kind of wall-to-wall coverage of Mike Huckabee walking around Iowa, you know, putting out his Republican talking points and all this kind of stuff. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders today introduced legislation to break up the nation's biggest banks. Congressman Brad Sherman, Democrat from California, in the House of Representatives, introduced a similar bill in the House. The press release from Bernie says the biggest banks in the United States are now 80% bigger than they were 1 year before the financial crisis in 2008, when the Fed provided $16 trillion in near-zero interest loans and Congress approved a $700 billion bailout. Never again should a financial institution be able to demand a federal bailout, Sanders said. And it goes on from there. So why is that not being covered? Why is the news not talking about that? Bernie, last night, Shano and Danielle went to see Bernie here in town. He was speaking at an event here in Washington, D.C. Made a great speech, a lot of good points. None of the electronic media was there. Dave Weigel was the only reporter whose name you might recognize who was there, and he writes for Salon. Or Bloomberg. Bloomberg, thank you. Dave's a good guy, but it's like, where was everybody else? Oh, Bernie Sanders doesn't count. Why doesn't Bernie Sanders count? He raised more money in his first day than did Ted Cruz or Rand Paul or who's the third? Oh, Marco Rubio. Yeah, the three caballeros. He raised more money than any one of the three. Bernie Sanders is more of a legitimate and serious candidate for president of the United States right now than any of the Republican nominees who have announced. Any of them. They're all just running a scam. I mean, you know, the Republicans are all about making money, and one of the ways to make money is to run for president. You get rich. And with the way the campaign finance laws are, you get to keep the money, by and large. I mean, there's a few the hoops you have to jump through, but you know, Sarah Palin's still sitting on millions. It's amazing. Gary in Terre Haute, Indiana. Hey, Gary. Thanks for calling. What's
hey,
up?
Tom. Shoes for industry.
Shoes for industry. Hi. You and me with the Fireside Theater. There you go.
I saw Hillary last night.
Mm-hmm. In person?
Her thing on immigration. All right. She announced that she was for comprehensive immigration reform.
Right.
Okay. I think Bernie got to her.
Well,
she would not have announced that any earlier unless of the press conferences or the presidential debates that they're going to go into.
This is an issue
I
that
think Bernie finally got to her.
I don't think so. Bernie is solid on this issue. I'll give you that. But it's not his front and center issue. His front and center issues are economic, and this is more, I mean, arguably it's an economic issue, but it's also a social issue. I think that, what she's doing is very strategic, which is wise, you know, when you're running for president, which is trying to nail down the Hispanic vote in the United States.
Well, that could come down when they have the presidential debates, when he goes forward to say, close down the banks. She won't be able to do that because she's backed by the banks.
We'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, I guess to some extent, it may depend on how much money she gets, how fast before she could walk away. I don't know. I don't know. I do know the Supreme Court's at risk and in this election. And, whoever the Democratic Party nominates, I will support. But that said, I think that Bernie is doing great stuff, but I think that Hillary's announcement on immigration has more to do with say what? Yeah. Oh yeah. And yesterday was Cinco de Mayo. Yeah. I think it has more to do with the Hispanic vote than it does with Bernie. But I get your point, Gary. And if your point is that Bernie's pushing her to the left, that's fine. But my goal is to get elected a president who is actually going to to renounce Reaganism. And that's the, and that's not the left, by the way. That's pushing to the center. And we have not had a president denounce or renounce Reaganism since Reagan. And it's high time. Bernie's the first guy who's actually talking in those kind of terms. Gary, thank you for the call. Dan in Great Lakes, Illinois. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Once again, God bless you for the work that you do. Tom, this is based on pure observation, working at a federal installation over the last 30 years. The conversations that I've had with white people, I'm a black man, they think that the Republican Party, the people who are conservatives or Republicans, they think that that party's not talking to them. And one of the first arguments that I had many years ago about so-called Reaganomics was that a man that I worked with, he loved to hear the word liberals fall off of his tongue. And he was always talking about, you know, welfare queens, et cetera, the typical Reagan jargon.
Right.
And what I pointed out to him was, we're civil servants. I said, we'll just say his name was Charlie. I said, Charlie, you talk as if you're Ivan Boesky or Michael Milken on Wall Street. These people want to do away with, this was the first time that we had heard in very strong language, privatization of government. Yeah. They want to do away with federal workers. I said, you are, and at that time, he was a GS-4 federal worker. I said, you're not a millionaire. They're talking about doing away with your job. And I might add to that, that many of these people that I've worked with over the years that are conservative, that are federal employees, they're some of the laziest people you ever want to meet. They, you know, they're always in trouble. There's all types of substance abuse, all kinds of problems, Tom. They think that they're not talking to them. So I honestly think that this is a white issue. They're getting a lot of mileage out of their being a black man as the occupant of the White House. They use bigotry, racism, and I'm going to go as far to say this. I think alcohol plays a lot to do with this as well. People are far too easily distracted, and they're able to just use that to take every dime that's in their pocket away from them.
Yeah, alcohol and the media, too. I mean, it's look at all these shows glorifying cops and everything else, and sometimes a very right wing in their sub messages. But yeah, I think that bigotry, racism, and alcohol turning people into suckers on the part of the Republicans, that's a great start, Dan. Great analysis. I think you're right. And by the way, while we're looking at, and we can look back, you know, in retrospect, 6.5 years now, at how intense the racial hatred is in coming out of the conservatives and the Republicans, and the ways that it shows up, coded as it is, it's still clear and obvious. Misogyny, the hatred of women, is as great a force as racism, and frankly, in my opinion, it is in the United States, maybe all around the world, probably all around the world, a greater force than racism. So I think if Hillary Clinton becomes president, she's gonna get it too, and you know, we'll see where it goes. But, Dan, I think you're spot on. Thanks a lot for the call. Andy in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You started the show off discussing, what was it, circus at Bread and
Circus. Bread and Circus, the old Roman thing. You know, keep the people happy, and then you can do whatever you want.
It almost sounds like, when you said it, it was some sort of Republican policy. But I think that it's really not necessary to even go there. Since all the most of the big media outlets are owned by right wing, you know, forces, I mean, all they have to do is just not talk about what Bernie Sanders is saying. It's
Which is exactly what they're doing. There's essentially a media blackout on Bernie.
Yeah, I mean, they just don't have to talk about it, and they've sort of won that thing. And in past elections, like 2000, 2008, 2004, social media has actually been a savior in some ways to the information.
Yeah.
But now everybody's savvy to that. And if you do a Google search now on any issue, you will get the first three pages of Google will be the Breitbart, the Blaze, ultra-right-wing blogs. I mean, that's what you get, and they're right on to that. If you want to find out what's the truth on this issue, they're in charge of that. They're sort of in charge of that. So I guess what I'm saying is some way has to be found for a guy like Bernie, who is, like you said, outfunded all these other clowns who are getting all the attention. does it take a rocket scientist to figure out why that's happening? And can we get around that? That's what. How can we get around that?
Well, the way that we're going to get around it, and Bernie talked about this last Friday, was if the corporate media, the so-called mainstream media, if the corporate media in the United States is going to black out Bernie, if they're going to ignore him because they don't like his positions, and many of his positions are not things that would make GE more profitable or make Comcast more profitable, or, I mean, he was in favor of net neutrality, too, Comcast owns NBC, or that would not make Disney more profitable or whatever, then the only alternative, the fallback option that is available to him and to us is what you just said, anti-social media. I mean, you know, get out there and just pound on Facebook. There's Bernie Sanders has a great Facebook page. And, you know, get over there, join up, like things, sign up, go to BernieSanders.com. We're going to have to do it as a movement. Organized money is opposed to Bernie. Organized money is opposed to progressive Americans. Organized money, frankly, in the form of corporations and billionaires, are opposed to the existence of the American middle class. They'd like us all to be working poor, and you know, all the more to them. So we just, you know, Andy, thank you for the call. So we've got to be the movement, and every single one of us, you know, anybody can go, you know, anybody who's a Facebook member, I guess, can go over to Bernie's site and say, yeah, I like that. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So the ways that Republicans, I got to tell you about what they're doing with prison phone calls. It's just another example of the insanity of this ideology. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jim in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I got some interesting news for you. Yesterday, I was watching Hillary's press conference there in that school, and
Is this on C-SPAN?
On C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. And before she got on, C-SPAN was taking calls like they normally do, and every caller was talking about Bernie, even Republicans. Republicans supporting Bernie. I was laughing. C-SPAN turned around and said, "It apparently showed, or apparently Bernie Sanders has won the C-SPAN." Primary. So
wow.
Yeah.
See, C-SPAN is not corporate media. I mean, you know, it's a nonprofit organization that's funded by licensing fees essentially from cable companies, and its job is to serve the public interest, even in the absence of a fairness doctrine, is to get, you know, information to the American people, and that's amazing. Did anybody call to support Hillary during Hillary's press conference?
Well, actually, they were just waiting. They had that little interim where they were waiting for her to arrive, and everybody was talking about Bernie. And like I said, even Republicans, they said, oh, yeah, that senator guy from New Hampshire, whatever his name is.
Right.
The guy was like, oh, Bernie Sanders. The guy goes, yeah. He goes, he's a guy that's for the people, man. And you just love to hear that, man. And to me, that's the important thing with Bernie. We got to get him out there and talk to people. He can't lose if he talks to people, man.
You're right. You're right. And when people hear Bernie speak and when they meet Bernie, they get it. They just so get it. I can tell you this from having lived in Vermont for 10 years. You get it when you meet this guy that he's the real thing. He's the real McCoy. There is not a phony bone in Bernie's body. Jim, thanks for the call. Thanks for the tip on that. That's fascinating. Joan in Ketchikan, Alaska. Or no, is that Alaska or Arkansas? It's
Alaska, Tom.
Oh, Alaska. Yeah, okay.
Hey, good morning. I was watching you the other night, last night, I think, and you were talking about reasons for Hillary to come out, what would happen politically with Hillary coming out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I had a couple things you said and Republican response, and I had another idea that if Hillary were to come out against the Fast Track Authority, she could really separate herself out from her husband. She would no longer be just Mrs. Bill Clinton. She could actually come out and show that she's different from him.
Right. I agree.
She could also like cover some of her Wall Street base, you know, by saying, it's just the Fast Track Authority she's against, and that transparency is always better.
Right. Yeah, Fast Track Authority is an assault on the Constitution. The trade bill is an assault on the middle class, and they're two separate things. You're right, and she could arguably separate those. and, you know, might be able to get some political mileage. I think she has to walk carefully on this because she was part of this administration, and this administered the Obama administration. The Obama administration is supporting both Fast Track and TPP. And so if she, and she's going to need Barack Obama a lot as she runs for president. And that's why I think that she's walking, she's trying to thread this needle very carefully, or whatever, you know, take your favorite cliche. You know, because she doesn't want to hurt the guy that she's going to need to campaign for her once the election is rolling. Because Obama is still very popular in the United States. I think always has been. Joan, thank you for the call. Interesting idea. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. So this is how sick and twisted it's become here in the United States with the intrusion of the profit motive into everything, right? We used to say, oh, that's just the profit motive, as if, you know, look out. Somebody's going to try and pick your pocket. Somebody's going to try to take advantage of you. But Reaganism elevates the profit motive to being the ultimate motivator of all things and people and thus the best thing in the world. Well, that might be true if you're making jeans or clothes, you know, or cars or computers. Of course you want to make a profit. Right? You're running a small business or a large business. It doesn't matter. You should be able to make a profit. But running a prison? When the government is running the prison? And a private for-profit phone company comes in that basically just provides prison phones? That made $1 billion in profit last year, not revenue, profit, according to the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog. In 2013, the FCC passed a rule that would cap phone calls that prisoners are making, which right now can cost as much as $17 for a 15-minute call, to cap them at 25 cents a minute. Now, even 25 cents a minute is a ripoff. Right, every prison in America right now, there's enough free and super cheap internet phones out there, you know, that they could, you know, get a Vonage or whatever the other ones are. I forget the names of all these different companies that are offering what's called voice over internet protocol, VOIP, VoIP phones. But the sheriffs, this is where it gets bizarre. The prison industry makes over $1 billion a year in profits, and state and county governments get commissions. Sometimes as much as 94% of the cost of the call, which means that tens or maybe hundreds of billions of dollars, at least tens of billions of dollars, have been extracted from prisoners and their families. And as Deborah Golden, an attorney with the D.C. Prisoners Rights Project, told Think Progress, this is just another tax on poor people and people of color. Well, and it's also part of the Republican philosophy, right? If government is doing something and you can figure out a way to tweak it a little bit so that private industry can make a buck off it, whether it's our vote or our prisoners or our schools. Go for it. Hey, make some money. Donald in Oak Park, Illinois. Hey, Donald.
Yes. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good.
The thing is, you know, you mentioned something about the benefits that the Republican Party has taken away from the veterans. Well, I might have said this before. I'm a veteran and I'm a senior citizen. I hope they stick it right to the veterans and the senior citizen. Now, if that sounds unpatriotic, let me tell you, they voted for the Republicans. 58% of my fellow veterans voted for the Republicans. My sister works in a retirement community. They're all for the Republicans. They talk about getting rid of Social Security. They talk about getting rid of decreasing the veterans veteran benefits. Well, the same thing holds true for the Hispanics and the gays. The Hispanics were never there for the election. We lost the Senate because they should have been a little bit more involved. And the gays, too. I watched a news flash about a bunch of them were in front of Washington. One of the signs that they were holding was, it said that if you want anything done, don't ask Obama. Now, my sister also works with a lot of them.
I think Obama's been quite proactive in terms of gay rights. He's the first president to acknowledge that gays should have the right to marry.
You'd be surprised how many gays are for Republicans.
Yeah, no, I
angry about this whole thing.
Yeah.
They better, I don't know what it's going to take to turn these people around and make them understand.
Well, we have to educate people. We have to inform them. There's a very simple question. You know, I can give you a long list of things Democrats have done for America in the last 100 years. Can you please name one thing that a Republican Party has done for the average working person in this country?
Nothing. I can't think of anything.
Right. Now. Nobody ever can. I mean, I've offered to give away books on this show to anybody who can call in and say, oh, here's something Republicans did in the last 100 years that who intentionally they did it for the benefit principally of working people or poor people. You know, you can't find anything. Everything that the Republican Party does is for rich people. Even when they do things that look like they're for working people and poor people, like Medicare Part D, the main beneficiary of Medicare Part D was not Medicare recipients. It was the drug companies because the Republicans put into the law that it was illegal to negotiate wholesale prices. So, with Medicare Part D, you get to pay $1 a pill for an aspirin. I mean, it's nuts. Excellent point, Donald. Thank you for the call. I don't want them to take away Social Security and veterans benefits so I can sit around and say, see, I told you so. I would much rather, you know, that America wakes up and says, oh, wait a minute, the Republicans are trying to do what? But, you know, when like this morning when NPR talks about the Republican budget and doesn't talk about the horrors that are in it, and when the media never talks about the horrors that are in it, and when, you know, they're covering, you know, Mike Huckabee like he's a rock star and they refuse to even have Bernie Sanders or talk to Bernie Sanders, I got a serious problem. Glenn in State College, Pennsylvania. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was watching a clip of Huckabee's closing speech, and there's a logical fallacy here, and I know you know the name for it, but he was saying things for the suckers, and it's misleading if you aren't watching for it. He will say things like, they are making Christian marriage illegal because they're for equal rights for marriage, or basically gay, because they're legalizing gay marriage. That, therefore, ergo, makes Christian marriage illegal.
Right.
Or he'll say other inflammatory things like, the Ayatollahs of Iran will know hell will freeze over before they get a nuclear weapon. And they're just eating it up. They're lapping it up out there in the audience. And it's totally illogical. But they go for it. How do they do that? And they do it over and over again.
It's Guerin's big lie theory. If you tell a lie that is large enough and you repeat it often enough, people will believe it. In fact, if for nothing else, because of the audacity of it, they'll say, you know, well, he couldn't be saying that if it wasn't true. I mean, that's amazing, right? And the trick that Huckabee is doing, and it's not just Huckabee, but Huckabee's particularly good at it, is basically whenever. And we have a long history of this with race relations in this country as well. Whenever a group which has been historically harmed or marginalized or minimized or segregated, enslaved, hurt, whenever that group gets some rights, whether it's gay people getting the right to marry or African Americans getting the right to vote, the Republican shtick on it is that we white people are being hurt. I mean, that's the way that they pitch it to the white racists.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And ecowine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour, and Kevin Cruz is on the line with us. He's a historian, professor of history at Princeton University, author most recently of One Nation Under God, which I'm holding in my hand here, How Corporate America Invented Christian America, the website princeton.edu/history. Dr. Cruz, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. How Corporate America Invented Christian America. How?
Well, that's the best of the book. The idea of the book is that not that corporate America invented the very idea of Christian America. That had been around from the start, but that it helped implement the markers that Americans come to think of today when they assume that the country is a Christian nation. And as a recent poll show, you know, more than half of all Americans think the country already is a Christian nation.
57% of Republicans are in favor of declaring it.
That's right. That's right. And so either we should be or we already are. That's the, right. the debate on the right, at least. So the things that they point to, One Nation Under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, Our God We Trust, the national motto, the national a day of prayer, which is tomorrow, the national prayer breakfast, things like that. Many people assume that these are with us from the founders, but they're actually all inventions of the 50s. And as I found in the book, they come about largely from a campaign that's engineered by corporate America.
So if I were to have asked my grandfather, who has passed away but who was a disabled vet from World War I, is America a Christian nation? He would have no idea what I'm talking about, by and large, right? Because he was, I mean, that was back in the 20s and 30s and 40s.
Right.
And so...
Well, so he might take it as, you know, well, sure, we're a nation of Christians, perhaps. But that's rather different than formally being a Christian nation.
Right.
So the Pledge of Allegiance that would have been said in his day would have been one that didn't have under God in it.
Right.
If you'd asked him what the national motto was, we didn't have an official national motto, but he would have said e pluribus unum.
Right.
He wouldn't have said
out of the many one. Right.
Right.
So basically what you're suggesting or what you've documented in your book is that a group of business people got together and said, and my language, not yours, we need to hire some shills to get out there and promote this idea that America is a Christian country so that we can bring the suckers in and exploit them politically, essentially. Am I sounding too cynical here?
Maybe a little too cynical, but you're not far off the mark. I mean, because they do quite consciously say that the reason they're getting ministers to make this case, and the reason they're using religious language in the first place, is that the arguments they want to make, kind of bare-bones arguments about how great capitalism is and how the New Deal is evil, that these aren't getting through. So they say, well, we need to gussy it up in religious language because that is what will sell. We need ministers to make this case for us because they're the most trusted people in America. So it is cynical in that end, yes.
Yeah, and it used to be the ministers who were the ones who more often than not were calling out the abuses of big business. I mean, you know, the involvement of churches in the civil rights movement. I mean, it goes all the way back to abolition. The involvement of churches in the women's rights movements goes back to the founding of this republic. So where you document in the book, for example, you know, bringing in Billy Graham and all these guys. Where, in a more contemporary sense, where does Mike Huckabee fit into all this?
Well, Huckabee, in a lot of ways, is an heir to this this movement. He's arguing, you know, again, he has said that God wrote the Constitution. That's a line that comes up a couple times in these writers in the 30s and 40s.
Right.
He, you know, believes that. You know, he's more of a social conservative, but the same arguments that are being done here to wed piety and patriotism are ones that I think animate his politics. So I think he's very much in the mix.
Right. And you know, capitalism is raw, unconstrained capitalism that is not, you know, well regulated, be sort of like a football game with no referees and no rules. I mean, it can be very, very brutal and very messy, and whoever has the most power ends up winning. It's antithetical to Christianity, isn't it, in a way? Laissez-faire capitalism.
Well, that's the way in which, again, you noted all these liberal ministers who supported liberal causes. They supported the New Deal for that reason.
Yeah.
They say, you know, The head of the Federal Council of Churches comes out and says the New Deal is essentially saying what we've been preaching from our pulpits. It's teaching people the value of things like security, the necessity of daily bread, they say.
Right.
And so there are many liberal ministers who are supporting this. And what you see in this movement I talk about in the book is an effort for businessmen to recruit ministers to their side to make what I think is an imaginative case that reconciles Christianity and capitalism and puts them against what they call the pagan statism of the New Deal.
Whoa. And you know, one of the arguments that was made against Roosevelt by the Republicans back in the day was that, you know, he was basically a communist or a socialist. And that, you know, Marx had said religion is the opiate of the people, and therefore he was anti-Christian. I mean, is this the narrative that is continuing to play out?
Absolutely. They paint both Roosevelt and Truman after him as agents of creeping socialism. Mm-hmm. And because socialism is connected in the minds of Americans with a godlessness, that therefore makes it un-American.
So this illustrates the confusion in Americans' minds. This is the thing that Bernie Sanders is dealing with right now. You know, he says, I'm a democratic socialist. You know, Finland, Norway, Denmark, you know, Sweden, Germany, France, they all consider themselves democratic socialists. Countries. And Bernie is like, you know, that's what I am. But the average American doesn't have any idea what socialist means, and they remember that the USSR was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and that's not good. And so
that's right. It's
like...
The term has been completely tainted, and it's something that really happens during the Cold War. But even earlier, I mean, even when the Soviet Union is America's ally in World War II, this language of, you know, the evil nature of socialism is one that's on the march, especially on the right, and so it becomes discredited in conservative circles early on, and they use this language to help weaken it across the board.
Right,
something seeming totally foreign to Americans.
Most of these changes you point out in the book, and in fact you open the book with the inauguration of Dwight Eisenhower. Most of these changes took place in the 50s, many of them during the Eisenhower administration. Was Eisenhower in on this, or was he just, I mean, he was a fairly religious guy, you know, in his farewell address, he ends with a prayer, and it's actually a very beautiful one. Did he think that the influence of religion would be benign?
He did. And so he's aligned with this Christian libertarian group. In fact, he probably would have been elected without them, but they're instrumental, I think, in ensuring a landslide victory. He works at this group, Freedom's Foundation, which is a part of this Christian libertarian trend.
This is 52 or his re-election in 56?
30 million pieces of their logo across the country right before the election.
Wow. Now, was that for his initial election in 52 or for his re-election in 56?
1952. In 1956, the message is the same. There are billboards in California that sum it up beautifully. A faith in God and country. That's Eisenhower. How about you?
Huh.
So they've wedded piety and patriotism perfectly there. But Eisenhower thought that this was a good thing. You know, he gets mocked for, as William Lee Miller of Yale University says, for being a very fervent believer in a very vague religion.
Right.
But that was the point. He knew that if he was trying to ram down a Baptist perspective or a Catholic perspective or anything like that, then he would alienate other sects. But if you can speak vaguely about one nation under God or in God we trust, he welcomes in Protestants, Catholics, and Jews alike.
Right.
And so he did away with the partisan origins of this. He actually went to betraying his Christian libertarian backers and making peace with the New Deal to their outrage. And he uses this religious language that they had always seen as a means to an end of rolling back the New Deal. He makes it an end unto itself.
And so
he quickly infuses the nation with this religious language.
Fascinating stuff. And he essentially ran on the New Deal in 56. I mean, you read the Republican Party platform. You know, we added these many union members. We increased the Social Security by this amount.
Yeah.
It's amazing stuff. Kevin Cruz, brilliant book. It is One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. Kevin, thank you for dropping by.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's amazing. I mean, the extent to which the ownership class will go to get the shills to bring in the suckers. Welcome back. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael. Bread and circus?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Yeah, I think the bread and circus of our days is technology. Cell phones, computers. No one really even talks to each other anymore in person. That is what is distracting both Democrats and Republicans. Then, as Danielle said, Video games are stealing our youth's minds and even some adults' minds, which produces apathy and our lack of really being aware of what's going on behind the scenes. What do you think?
I think, and I wrote about this in both Prophet's Way and The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, I think that the television is a drug, and I think the computers arguably are drugs also. And here's my rationale. The thing, and not just a drug, but an addictive, consciousness-altering drug. The way that we Correct. Define drugs is that they tend to be concentrated versions of something that exists in nature, but we intentionally concentrate them so that they can have a more potent impact. So you take, you know, coca leaf, which is fairly benign. You could chew coca leaf all day long, and it's like, you know, sipping on a cup of coffee all day, maybe sipping on four cups of coffee all day. But, you know, people have been doing this for 10,000 years down in Peru. But if you distill out of that the cocaine and then you give that to the person, bang, really fast, you know, hey, put this up your nose, then there's a woohoo, right? Same thing with TV. With TV, you know, they will take several days and compress it into 1 hour or even 30 minutes. They'll take, you know, the omniscience, you can see somebody 50 feet away and you can hear what they're saying, and then suddenly they cut to a close-up shot and then they're looking up at the sky. And I mean, it's reality, but it's reality that's been digested and concentrated in a way to make it have much more impact when it's basically dropped on the screen in front of you. And therefore, it fits into the description, the generally accepted psychological, anyway, description of an addictive drug. And the addiction part is that you can demonstrate that there are people who have a problem chipping television. Chipping is occasionally using, you know, with the most addictive drug in our society is tobacco. A very small percentage of people can chip tobacco. I think it's 5 to 8%, something like that. Most people get addicted to tobacco within a week. Heroin is far less addictive. There's some 30-40% of people can chip heroin, and then it goes, you know, down or up from there. Other drugs less addictive. But I've never seen a good study on how many people can chip television. How many people can turn on a television program or turn on the TV and ignore it, or, you know, not get sucked into it? And as you correctly point out, Michael, we give up our lives for this. This is the bread and circus. I say that being on TV, I realize. Although I think that I'm...
Can I ask you one last question?
Sure.
Now, you said you take the train from your boat to work.
More or less.
What's it like when you get on the train? Because people know you. Do people approach you all the time, or do they sit there? And
it's, you know, maybe 2-3 times a week somebody will come up and say, I love your show, or, you know, that kind of thing. But generally not. I am not a major superstar, Michael. I'm a minor celebrity, but I am on television here over the air in D.C., so that does produce that. So, yeah, it happens. Anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Michael. It's always great to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Biggest trade deficit in 6 years, $54 billion. We mentioned that. Hillary and immigration. Okay, this is all the stuff I've already gone through. What has the Republican Party done with things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Peace Corps, unemployment? They're opposed to all of them. They're absolutely opposed to all of them. And meanwhile, the Republicans in the Federal Election Commission have disabled that agency so that the billionaires in the election that's coming up in a year and a half can cheat and get away with it. And they've been notified of this. It's really, this is, you know, pretty astonishing. Here's this, I mentioned very early on in the program, the blog over at Daily Kos by a married gay guy who talked about how, you know, now that this woman, Sylvia Ann Driscoll has filed a lawsuit against all homosexuals. He and his partner are, you know, getting ready to go bankrupt. You know, it was all tongue in cheek. But here's the last paragraph of what she filed with the court. says, because I feel it is imperative to do so, life as a nation, as states, and as cities need to start standing up for the moral principles on which our great nation, our great states, and our great cities were founded. A sucker, right? Somebody got to her. This is what Kevin Cruz was talking about. She sued in federal court. It's Sylvia Andriscoll versus homosexuals. Plaintiffs versus defendants. And then, you know, she says that the homosexuals say it is not a sin to be a homosexual, that they have the right to marry. And then she says, I, Sylvia Andriscoll, refer your honor to paragraph 3, line 2 of defendants' homosexuality. They say it, and then, and God tells his children in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 23, thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. But, you know, she just is going off on this stuff. Somebody got through to her, right? Either, you know, hey, Sylvia Ann, come on in. You know, the Republicans, they got a place for you. You hate gay people. Yeah, we're all about that. That's the Republican Party. Okay, did I talk about these top 25 hedge fund managers, Shano? I don't, you know, okay. I wanted to get into this too. I'll do this very quickly. Because the second part of the story, you know, there's like two shoes. One gets dropped and then the second one gets dropped. The first one is that the top 25 hedge fund managers, hedge funds are these, you know, giant operations that basically manage your money and are supposed to hedge against failures in the market. That's where the original name came from. So they would buy things like, you know, options and derivatives to balance equities. Janet Yellen, by the way, this is kind of a little spooky, just said that equities are fairly high in value. You know, I don't have the exact phrase in front of me. But when I read that, I thought, oh, my God, this is just like when Alan Greenspan said there's froth in the market and, you know, basically predicting the crash. But in any case, top 25 hedge fund managers last year made $11.6 billion, 25 men, all of them are men, no women. Topping the list is Kenneth C. Griffin. He took home $1.3 billion last year. Now, you could argue that he was paid for what he did. His company is called Citadel, and it returned 18% to its investors. Now, if you simply bought the Standard & Poor last year, you just put your money in the stock market and said, buy an index fund that's all the S&P stocks, you would have made about 13% last year. This fund made 18%. Another one that was run by Mr. Ackman, Pershing Square Capital, gained 36%, and Ackman made $950 million. Now, that's interesting, one. See, because you and I can't buy into these hedge funds. You got to be really rich to put your money with a hedge fund. So you want to make 40% every year on your money? You got to have the money in the first place. This is not for people with a 401k, number one. Number two, most of the other hedge funds didn't do all that well. In fact, while the S&P posted a gain of 13.68% for the year, a lot of the hedge funds were producing returns of 3, 4, 5%. And they didn't do as well as the market itself. But even that's not the other shoe. That's not the amazing thing. They go on to say in this piece in the New York Times, deal book with founder Andrew Ross Sorkin. I'm sorry, for some reason the New York Times is printing gibberish on their headlines and subheads and credit lines, so I can't tell you who wrote this. Whoever wrote this in today's Times says, computer scientists whose firms use quantitative strategies were among the top earners last year. David Shaw, whose $36 billion D.E. Shaw firm hires data scientists to build algorithms for trading, made $530 million in 2014. In other words, they're making this money by not doing anything productive whatsoever. They're making this money by skimming money off the top of little tiny micro changes in the stock market. I mean, that's high frequency trading. There's a variation on that, and they're making money with money, but they're not even really making money. They're just taking money. Ayn Rand talks about the looters and the what's the other one? Takers and makers, right, and Daniel Quinn, the takers and leavers, right, takers and makers. And these are the takers. They've been the highest-earning managers have also, and here's the other shoe. They also now, remember Henry Wallace said that the fascists in America are those who want to combine economic power in the marketplace with political power. They're reaching out for political power so that they can essentially regulate themselves. From the New York Times, the highest earning managers have also emerged as leading political donors. For example, Mr. Griffin, whose $26 billion firm Citadel is based in Chicago, was the single largest backer for Rahm Emanuel. Last month, Citadel hired Ben S. Bernanke, the former Federal Reserve chairman, as a senior advisor. Right. You think that these guys aren't getting politically active to protect themselves? I mean, this is the big danger in a democracy. The big danger in a democracy is when the democratic institutions themselves are hijacked by people more powerful than the democratic institutions. And the Supreme Court, with the Buckley decision forward in 1976, has set this up for exactly that to happen. And that is the definition of fascism.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Meanwhile, I haven't seen Bernie once on this TV that I got in front of me all last hour and a half. And Bill de Blasio is coming out with a contract on America next week.
And now for something completely
crazy. You're so crazy.
You're crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Oh, now you're just being crazy.
Oh, welcome back. It's our crazy alert for the day. Vegan strip clubs. Ever wanted to see a strip show but couldn't because the silk-clad dancers offended you? Worry no more. Just head to Portland. Portland, Oregon is home to the world's first all-vegan mini mall, complete with its own vegan strip club. Portland has a history of supporting vegans and vegetarians since the 1800s when Seventh-day Adventists who avoid meat settled in the area. And what a paradise the city has become for vegans, especially if you want to see some skin without the fur or leather or pearls or even silk. It's not just how the strippers dress, though. The club's kitchen is 100% vegan, so no baby back ribs or endless shrimp, but plenty of tofu with your next lap dance. I would just add a little statistic that most people don't know, but I remember from having lived in Portland for 5 years. Portland is the only city in America with more strip clubs than churches. Fascinating fact. I've never been to one of the Portland strip clubs, but, you know, there's a lot of them. You drive around there, holy cow, there's a bunch of them. Here, there's an interesting sign, and I'm going to pick up your phone calls as soon as I share this story with you, but it's this just popped up over on Alternet. Zed Jelani writing, in Tennessee, the governor of Tennessee, who is a Republican, Bill Haslam, wanted to accept federal Medicaid dollars. He wanted the working poor in Tennessee. Keep in mind, the Medicaid expansion, which is part of Obamacare, is not for unemployed people. It's not for people, quote, on welfare. It's for people who are working and earning too much money, typically over $3,000 or $4,000 a year, earning too much money to be considered genuinely desperately poor, but not earning enough money to qualify for subsidies under the Obamacare exchanges. And Bill Haslam wanted to cover those people because they're dying in Tennessee. People are dying because there's no health care and they're working. I mean, you know, people who are, I mean, this is basically, you know, the minimum wage crowd in Tennessee. They can't afford health insurance. By and large, they're not getting it from their employers. And this is the whole point of expanding Obamacare. So he wanted to do it. And the Republicans in Tennessee wanted to do it. Now, in some states, like, you know, down in, I think it was Arkansas, they've, Republican governors have figured out a way to bring in an expansion of Medicaid in a way that will inure some profits to for-profit corporations. They'll say, fine, you know, we'll take the money from the federal government, say it's $1 billion, we'll take $1 billion, but we're going to give it to the health insurance companies who are going to skim, you know, $100 million off the top and then provide $900 million worth of benefits to the citizens of our states. They always figure out a way, and there have been three or four, maybe five Republican states that have done this, to, yes, we'll take the federal money, we'll expand Medicaid, but we'll do it in a way that's going to make money for our campaign donors. And they were trying to do that in Tennessee, which is, you know, it's the Republican way, but at least they were going to try and get everybody to have health insurance. And Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers group, comes into Tennessee and just blows this thing out of the water by buying television ads and lobbying like crazy. And now a group of Tennessee Republicans led by Bill Haslam published a long article in the Tennessean lashing out at the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity. This is amazing. Tom Ingram, who is the top political advisor to the Republican governor of Tennessee, wrote, quote, to some extent, some degree, the same thing is going on nationwide. He's talking about Citizens United. They, Americans for Prosperity, have a full-time staff. They've poured a lot of money indirectly and directly, says Ingram, who is registered to lobby last session for a pro-insure Tennessee business group. He says it's largely to push whatever agenda they have and influence, frankly, our elected officials, our issues, disproportionately more than any of us as individual voters can. I find something out of whack with that. The House Majority Leader, Republican, Gerald McCormick, Republican from Chattanooga. He says AFP very unfairly attacked Kevin Brooks. In particular, he did not say anything publicly and, as far as I know, privately about it. And you know, he goes on and on. I mean, it's basically war within the Republican Party over the Koch brothers. This is fascinating. As the old Chinese curse goes, we live in interesting times. Janice in Rogers, Arkansas, you wanted to get back to my comment about how they've figured out a way to squeeze more money out of the prisoners?
Yes, Tom. I've worked in the court system for a very long time, and my son made some bad choices and went to prison. The telephone companies that service the local, county, and state institutions, if you are placing a $25 deposit on their account, they automatically skim off $7. So then the inmate has $18 worth of phone calls to make. The first minute is $3 per minute, and then it's whatever it is per minute after that, and there's no accountability. There is no place that you can go and look up and see, well, how many minutes did I actually use? Because I don't think I used that many minutes.
Right.
It's just a big scam. And then the other thing is if you think, well, I'm going to circumvent and I'm going to put a $100 deposit down, thinking it will still just be the $7, it's $28 off of the top.
Wow. So wow. And this is an industry that made $1 billion profit, according to ThinkProgress last year.
Exactly.
$1 billion profit off
and
prisoners.
Yes. Well, their families.
Yeah.
But the problem is that when your child goes to prison or your family member goes to prison, they give you a pamphlet that tells you how important it is that you maintain contact with them.
Right.
Phone service, visits, mail. But then the poor inmates, there's no way that
right.
they can't
afford the phone
contact
calls.
Their families.
Yeah.
So people like me, my son, I would always have a notepad and a pen. My son would give me a list of names of the person to contact and the person in prison so they could tell their families where they were.
Wow.
Because if they don't have internet service, they have no way of knowing where their child is.
This is, you know, we so need to, I was going to say, you know, tear it down and start over, but that's not necessary. We need to reverse the Reagan revolution. We need to go back to the idea that government can do things well and that we don't need $1 billion profit, for-profit phone companies in our prisons. We don't need, you know, $1 billion profit or hugely profitable for-profit food companies in our prisons. We don't need private prisons, period. We shouldn't be privatizing our schools. We shouldn't be privatizing our roads. We shouldn't be privatizing our electric and water and everything else. It's nuts. Janice, thank you for calling and sharing your story. It's unfortunate. Ray in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. You have a lot of listeners and callers from WCPT in Chicago. So there's something happening as I speak in Chicago regarding the Chicago public school system. It's a perfect example of the inordinate amount of corporate influence, and even more importantly, how well-planned and sneaky it is.
Okay.
As usual, Republicans are leading the way, but some Democrats are involved in this, too. I called you last week about the Commercial Club of Chicago and the role I think it plays in Obama's position on TPP. Okay, well, the club's two big issues are to privatize Chicago schools and turn state pensions for public employees, including teachers, into 401ks. Bruce Rauner is a member. He ran on turning pensions into 401ks and doing what Republicans always do, blaming debt on pensions and then pitting those who have lost their pensions or had them taken away against the people who still have them. Emanuel is also a member. He's been after the Chicago Teachers Union, which has 30,000 members, since he came to office. But somehow he managed to get the support of unions in the town, And he swore to change his ways when he did his acceptance speech after the recent, runoff election.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mayor appoints school board members. The school board president is and has been a guy named Vitale. He's a member of the club, and usually half the members are. The school board has been closing public schools and funneling properties and tens of millions of dollars to charters. They closed 50 last year alone. Now they say they have a one-plus billion debt crisis and say teachers have to start paying their own pension contributions, which would represent a $5,000 pay cut. So they're basically running CPS like a venture capitalist-run businesses. They acquire. They funnel money coming into a business to themselves and investors, or in this case, some things they're interested in, and then they run up to debt and then declare a crisis and say their workers have to pay for it. And Ronners actually spoke to the city council today, something that's never happened before in Chicago's history. His proposal was for the CPS to declare bankruptcy and get rid of their legacy costs in terms of pensions and all those obligations and renegotiate all the salary contracts.
Right.
And while Emmanuel was dealing with the runoff election, Ronner's actually been going around the state and also urging to put pressure on the Democratic legislature to pass right-to-work laws that allow municipalities outside of Chicago to have right-to-work laws locally. So he's not going to try to take on Chicago. But now today, Emmanuel gets through this election, and Ronner amounts what I would call a frontal assault on the unions by coming to Chicago, speaking to Chicago City Council, which has never been done, and advocating, you know, declaring bankruptcy.
Ronner is your governor.
Yeah.
Right.
Ronner's the governor.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
And he's a Republican, isn't he?
I don't think anybody in Chicago even has ever heard of the Commercial Club of Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was surprising to me when you called, and then maybe you sent it to me. Somebody sent me a list of the complete membership, and it was like, 40, 50 pages. But it was some recognizable names and a lot that I didn't. But,
and, you know, one of the things, too, if you look on there, you'll find some from the Tribune and the Sun-Times.
Yeah.
Some of the leaders or owners of those or editors, sure, or whatever are also members of that club. So
And these 401ks, you know, they're the children of IRAs, and IRAs are the children of the Reagan administration. And it was just an effort to get the average person to think of themselves as an investor in the stock market so that they wouldn't mind when the Republicans did policy moves that basically helped people who invest in the stock market. And it was so cynical and continues to be. And it's a ripoff. It's a total ripoff. Ray, thank you for the call. We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day, and the Talk Radio News Service in just a few minutes. Welcome back. Let's see here. Catherine in Monterey, California. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Oh, good morning, Tom. Yeah, well, I have an incident of when our Republicans did something to help everyday people.
Really?
Yeah, what? So in 1969, when Richard Nixon became president, he appointed his opponent in the primary, George Romney, to be head of secretary of HUD.
Right.
And the plan was to really push in the cities, especially the big city areas, to really do a big push for affordable housing.
Right.
And Romney actually did that for 3 years. There was a lot of blowback from the usual suspects, you know, the Business Roundtable and all the Republicans in powerful positions, but Romney wouldn't quit.
Yeah.
And so they decided it wasn't politically expedient to fire him, and so he was able to keep doing that until 1973, when Richard Nixon caved to all the pressure and froze all the housing subsidies.
Wow.
And when he did that, Romney resigned.
Wow. So, you know, George Romney, Mitt's dad, and,
that's,
you know,
right.
I remember I was a little kid when he was the governor of Michigan. So, and I,
mm-hmm.
you know, my father thought fondly of him, but my dad was an Eisenhower Republican, and I think George Romney was too, arguably. And,
yeah.
But that's not. You don't win the prize here, Catherine, because what I'm saying is please name a legislation or policy that the Republican Party has, has originated as an idea, put forward, turned into law that only benefits average working people or the poor. Here you have an example of one good Republican who is trying to do good against, you know, against the wishes of his party, and he was ultimately defeated.
Well, but he did actually do that for 3 years.
Right. Okay. All right. I'll split the difference with you. George Romney was apparently a decent secretary of HUD, but I'm still wary of the Republican Party. Catherine, thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. Terry in Portland, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. We just have a minute to the break. Terry, quick one.
Okay, Tom, really quick. I just wanted to tell you, in Oregon, I have a young man I write to. He works full-time, 40 hours a week, and earns a whopping $29 a month.
He's in jail?
Oh, yeah. And I was telling Danielle, their phone system is a little more liberal here in Oregon. We're not privatized, but like a 15-minute Skype costs him $9 if his, you know, family members have Skype.
Right.
Quickly, can you tell me, if I had some information I wanted to share with you about Hillary Clinton, where would be the best place to contact you with an email?
Post it on the homepage of our website on my daily blog as a comment on there. I read those.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Appreciate all you do. And
sure.
Go for me.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Stick around. Luke Vargas, the Talk Radio News Service, up next, and then your calls. Place where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman program. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. This Mother's Day, give a crystal heart to your mother. It's the goatsfortheoldgoat.com mother to mother program. These are made by mothers in South Sudan who saw family members murdered in front of them. Luke Vargas is with us, live from Scotland. Do I have that right, Luke?
That's correct, Tom. Good to join you.
So what's going on in the UK and Scotland that has you over there?
Quite a lot. There are big UK general elections tomorrow, Scotland being sort of the swing vote in a way after that failed independence referendum last year. The Scottish National Party, which is quite pro-independent but also representing the political left, Kingdom has really increased its support, and in a way is proving to be sort of the kingmaker in these elections. This is a party that is only polling about 3% nationwide, but stands to pick up the most seats really of any party here, winning over pretty much this whole part of the country, which has for decades been a Labour stronghold. And, you know, here we are 12 hours before the voting begins, and even the best pundits here really can't call where this election is going to go. It's just such an interesting confluence
of
party positions.
I mean, right now you've got a coalition between David Cameron, who is, you know, kind of a white, we would call him not quite a wacko bird Republican, but, you know, sort of maybe a Bob Dole Republican or a George Bush Republican. And but not like, you know, Ted Cruz crazy, and then on the his coalition partners, Nick Clegg, who is with the Liberal Democrats, who is somewhere between Barbara Boxer and Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's quite progressive, but he has very little power because he's the subordinate party in that kind of dual running the country thing. Might that flip?
Yes, it certainly could flip in a way. I mean, I'll address both of those. So Cameron is having a tough time selling his austerity to most of this country. You know, he really pissed off so many different constituents. He tripled student university fees and caused...
I'm listening.
He implemented the bedroom tax, which is sort of a welfare reform, seek to punish benefit recipients who have extra bedrooms in their house that they're not using, essentially having more property than you are deemed to need. But he also raised the VAT tax, the value-added tax. This was seen as unpopular, particularly as he lowered the income tax for the wealthiest 10% of Brits.
Well, that's because he was a conservative. That's what they do.
Yes. So that's sort of tough, staking out two different positions for the wealthy and the needy is seen as quite.
He essentially did what Sam Brownback did in Kansas. You know, you raise the sales tax and lower the income tax on rich people. It's amazing. So, okay, so that's the UK.
It can only go so far.
Yeah.
That is being made.
They will, so we'll see how this plays out. Meanwhile, Netanyahu just has, if I understand this correctly, has not yet formed a government. It's been, what, 4 weeks, 6 weeks? It's been a while since the Israeli elections. And maybe 2 weeks. You tell me. I don't do time. I'm sorry. But what's the deal with this?
Yeah, well, he was April 20th to put together a coalition. He asked for a 2-week extension. He was granted that. And here we are, 5 hours away from midnight in Jerusalem, and no coalition has been formed. This seemed to be a strategic move by Avigdor, foreign minister of the country, to basically at the last minute, the last possible hour, tell Netanyahu he was not going to join his coalition government. We have received reports that members of his party have not even been answering the phone as Netanyahu's allies try and contact him to make some sort of deal. It looks like he may be able to put this together with the support of the Jewish Home Party of Naftali Bennett. But again, the most optimistic predictions are that he would have a majority of one seat. It's just sort of ironic because these elections were called by Netanyahu because he felt like he could actually improve his hand, that by calling snap elections, he would be able to strengthen his projections, having such a weak majority that it looks like every vote he's going to need to be playing, to the interests of certain voters, as they call them, to every interest, just to get even the simplest legislation passed. So this doesn't look like a coalition that's going to stand the test of time. Israeli governments come as quickly as they go. And again, the likelihood is that, you know, we might be seeing Israeli elections way sooner than we had expected. Netanyahu, really, I don't know how this is going to come together or when it's going to come together, but this is an embarrassment at a time when he thought he had really exceeded his expectations, doing so well in that come-from-behind result in March.
Right. And meanwhile, France looks like they're going all in on the French version of the Patriot Act. What's the deal? Luke?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost you for a second, but you're back.
Sorry, Tom. Intelligence reforms that were drafted just really Hebdo attacks gives you a sense of sort of the fact that many people view them to be a knee-jerk reaction to sort of the how scared people were. These reforms implement a lot of the most troubling things that have been identified by Edward Snowden about the NSA's own practices. This would be the bulk collection of internet communications, of phone records by telecoms and internet service providers. There would be ability to, go after, rights about this, but it passed easily yesterday. Again, yes, to draw some sort of correlation with is not unfair at all. And yes, this seems to have gone through without much opposition from the French National Assembly yesterday.
So once again, the crazies win. They try to scare the country into sacrificing its values. And it's 9/11. We did here. We gave up a lot. George W. Bush did exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted, and it looks like the French government is responding to their 9/11, their Charlie Hebdo attacks. That is so unfortunate. Luke Vargas for the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Tom.
And have a great time there in Edinburgh. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Interesting kind of breaking news. Just got this in an email from the Bold Progressives, T.J. Helmstetter. He's been a guest many times on our TV show. He says, Tom, this is huge. Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook, just embraced debt-free college on CNBC this morning. The first time the Clinton campaign has done so publicly. The PCCC, 5,000 Democratic leaders and over 50 members of Congress, including Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren, have been urging Democrats to make this a centerpiece issue. And so here's what Hillary Clinton's campaign manager said on CNBC's Squawk Box just a few hours ago. By the way, today is May 6th. Happy birthday, Sean. Happy birthday to you. No, you're not. Actually, I'm not supposed to sing that song, am I? Because then they can get royalties. Pardon? I didn't sing it? Okay. I did it so badly, I didn't even sing it. Okay. Happy birthday, Sean. All right, Sean Taylor, our executive producer, today is her birthday. And oh, we love you, Sean. We really appreciate you. Okay, so back to May 6th just reminded me of that. Clinton campaign manager, Robbie Mook. He says, what voters are looking for is someone to be a champion for everyday people. For young people, that's debt-free college. That's finding that job after you graduate. And for seniors, that's standing up for Social Security and Medicare. And Hillary obviously has a long history doing that. So we're looking across the board, and we're going to fight for every single vote in every single state. And Adam Green, the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, said, it is nothing short of monumental that the Clinton campaign has embraced the idea of debt-free college, a top priority for young people, working parents, and the progressive movement. Democrats will win big in 2016 if debt-free college is endorsed and elevated as a central campaign theme. Keith Ellison came out and applauded it. Chuck Schumer, Martin O'Malley has said this. Federal investment in debt-free college is 71% of America. When you poll Americans and say, do you think that the federal government should pay for college so the kids can go to school debt-free? In other words, free college. 71% of Americans say yes, 19% of Americans say no. It was the number one issue that Democrats who didn't vote in 2014 said would have motivated them to vote. This is pretty astonishing. They've got 50 co-sponsors for this thing, the Grijalva, Ellison, Clark resolutions, and the Schatz, Schumer, Warren initiative. The Washington Post. Anyway, it's fascinating. So here's the question. And in fact, let me just take this a little step further. There's a piece here in Politico today by Mike Allen that starts out, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, who, by the way, is probably one of the more prominent, probably one of the most prominent, most progressive politicians in America. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, using his muscular perch to try to nudge the National Democratic Party to the left. See, I'd say it's to the center. I mean, if 71% of Americans want debt-free college, that's not the left. That's the center. That's a majority. In fact, that's a supermajority. Anyway. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, using his muscular purse to try to nudge the National Democratic Party to the left. Next week, they have to keep saying nudge because this is just the corporate media narrative. But in any case, next week we'll unveil a 13-point progressive agenda that he hopes will be the left's answer to the contract with America, which helped propel Newt Gingrich in the Republican Revolution of 94. Now, I remember the contract with America. And there were 10 items in it, and six of them, when you dug into them, and this was back in the 90s, and the Internet was just sort of, well, back then it was CompuServe. In fact, I was running a bunch of forums on CompuServe. You had CompuServe or AOL. Those were your choices. And, you know, with a 300 baud modem or a 1200 baud modem, maybe a 1200, maybe 2400 if you could get really fancy. But back then, I remember running forums on CompuServe, these conversations about the contract on America, or with America. I always called it contract on America that Newt Gingrich laid out. And if you tracked back each of the pieces of legislation that each one of the items in the contract with America pointed to, it would be things like, you know, an item in the contract with America might be something like, you know, strengthen America's middle class. And you point to points to a piece of legislation. You check the legislation out. Six of the 10 items pointed to the same piece of legislation, which was a bill to cut taxes on rich people. Help the job creators, right? I mean, you know, they've been peddling this lie since the 1920s. So anyhow, Bill de Blasio is going to roll out these 13 points. And I'm curious, what should they be? What should they be? What should, and where did my copy? Where is it? I'm looking for Rebooting the American Dream. Oh, it's right here. Okay, and what should our agenda be? I wrote this book, Rebooting the American Dream, and I laid out what my agenda would be, or what I think an American agenda would be. This is not me like I'm running for political office, because I'm not. Bernie Sanders read from this book during his nine-hour filibuster on the floor of the Senate, which was a great honor to me. And then he went even a step farther. He signed a cover letter. We took 99 books over to the Senate. Bernie wrote 99 letters to each one of his colleagues, individually, you know, personalized letters, saying, please read this book. So here are my 11 things, and I'm curious what you would add to this or take away from it. Let's brainstorm this together. How do we bring back the American dream? This is from my book, Rebooting the American Dream. Chapter 1 is titled, Bring My Job Home. The first chapter is all about trade. Right, how our trade policy used to work, starts out with George Washington, how it used to work and how it works now and how badly it's been destroyed by Reaganism. Chapter 2, roll back the Reagan tax cuts. I think that's fairly self-explanatory. Chapter 3, stop them from eating my town. This is the Sherman Antitrust Act. Stop the big corporations. Let small family businesses come back and start occupying downtowns and malls and things. Chapter 4, an informed and educated electorate. This is calling for fully funding public education, pre-K and post-public schools, in other words, in college, including graduate school. Chapter 5, Medicare Part E, Medicare for everybody. Bernie's been saying this forever. Chapter 6, make members of Congress wear NASCAR patches. Now, there's transparency about where their money's coming from. Or actually, the real call for action there was amend the Constitution to reverse what the Supreme Court said in Citizens United. Chapter 7, cool our fever. In other words, let's do something about global warming before we're all dead. Chapter 8, they will steal it. This is about foreign policy. It's a lesson that Dick Gregory taught me, actually, once. We were on a plane flying across the Atlantic on our way to, we were on our way to Germany, and from there we flew down to Kenya and down to Nairobi and then to Entebbe, to Uganda. And he talked about how, you know, if you got something good, you don't have to force it down people's throats with a barrel of a gun. If you got something good, they will steal it. And, you know, so let's support democracy movements around the world. It's foreign policy, Chapter 8. Chapter 9, put Lou Dobbs out to pasture. In other words, we need a comprehensive approach to immigration reform that actually works. Reagan certainly did not do that back in 86? I think it was 83, 86 that he did his, And Chapter 11 is titled In the Shadow of the Dragon, and for that chapter, Louise and I traveled to Mondragon in Spain, the workers' cooperative, the multi-billion-dollar workers' cooperative, the largest in the world. And it basically lays out alternatives to capitalism, cooperatives, worker-owned businesses, these kinds of things that could be, you know, that could enhance the American economy, but don't require an ownership class, a billionaire class, to function. Okay. So those are my suggestions. I don't know what de Blasio is going to say, what Mayor de Blasio is going to say. He's got 13. I just laid out 11. And I'm curious what yours are. If any of the ones that I pointed out you think are super important or shouldn't be there, what should the progressive agenda be this year and next year as we go into the elections? 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Maybe we can write a platform for the Democratic Party. Get it started right here. Your call's up next. Welcome back. Diana in Agora Hills, California. Hey, Diana, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Oh, you're awesome, Tom. And by the way, I saw you at the Sister Giant Conference, and you were spectacular. But I have to say, Bernie Sanders just blew my mind. He was magnificent.
Yeah, he was.
So I encourage anybody, if they get a chance to see him in person, he really, it comes on so strong and so distinguished and just inspiring. So I had to say that first.
Yep.
My question, and I don't hear anybody talking about it, and I have heard you discuss and a few others discuss how if the TPP does go through, game over, we lose our sovereignty. So, but here's the question beyond that. If TPP goes through, what difference does it make which party's in charge of Congress or who holds the presidency? Because basically these will just be a ceremonial like the Queen of England. We will have no power with which to exercise our democracy. Our constitution will be gutted. So why isn't the conversation going in that direction, discussing that threat represented by the TPP? We'll be reducing politicians to clerical status, glorified administrators. Right. What do you think, Tom?
You're right, Diana. And it's interesting to see how this is knocked down by both sides. We had on our TV show, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we had a Republican, or was it here on radio? We had a Republican commentator, very, very conservative guy, who came on and he was talking about TPP, and he was just, yeah, I know it was TV. And he was just, in fact, if Sean is listening, it would be great to book that guy for the radio show as well, because I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. But what's interesting to me, Diana, is that Democrats tend to react to TPP as, oh my God, it's another one of those trade deals that's going to ship our jobs overseas, which it is. Republicans are reacting to TPP, at least the genuine, you know, the small remnant of the Republican Party that has any integrity left or any values left are responding to it with the sovereignty argument, this concern about sovereignty. I share both concerns. You know, the fact that we are, you know, we fought and died, you know, multiple generations of Americans to create a country that was a sovereign nation. And with TPP, much like we did with NAFTA and CAFTA, you know, with NAFTA, we turned over some of our sovereignty to both Canada and Mexico and corporations therein. Now we're turning them over to, what is it, 19 or 22 or 24 countries in the Southern Hemisphere in Asia, which is why I call it the Southern Hemisphere Asia Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA. That's the net of it, Diana. We need to be talking about both.
Right. But it's frightening that we need to keep pushing the argument beyond just losing the jobs and, you know, gutting labor. But the other side of that is that I think President Obama is pushing so hard, because I've heard you voice your concern about not understanding why he's doing this. I understand why he's pushing so hard, because he's got to do it before the next president comes in. If it's a Democrat, then that Democrat's going to be able to say, well, there isn't much I can do. I know I wanted to, deliver X, Y, and Z, but at this point, this trade agreement happened under the previous administration, and we just got to comply with the treaty arrangements that...
Keep in mind, this fast-track authority that is being promoted right now is for 6 years. It's for the rest of President Obama's presidency and for the first term of the next president. And I'm very ambivalent about that. I'm wondering if that might be, you know, if Hillary might think, hey, I'd love to have that if I was president. I don't know. Diana, thank you for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And well, there's a lot to talk about here today. Andy in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, you wanted to talk about an earlier caller who was talking about seniors and vets benefits being cut by Republicans?
The situation is, if the Republican Party were able to totally destroy Social Security, leaving millions of seniors out on the street in such a way that it was totally obvious that the Republicans did it, and they did it because they wanted to do it, okay? And if they were to cut veterans' benefits so that when a guy in Afghanistan is discharged from the military, he would have to find his own way home. You know, I mean, really, really cut veterans' benefits to the bone. The Republicans would find a way to say, well, we had to do this because of the Democrats.
Right.
You'd have a bunch of Republican suckers on the street saying, look what the Democrats did to my Social Security.
Right.
Look what the Democrats did to my veterans' benefits. They always find a way to do stuff that harms the middle class and then turn it around on the Democrat.
Well, and sometimes they get a Democrat to go along with it. I mean, they had Obama there for a while talking about chain CPI. But, you know, it's like the pressure from Wall Street for this thing is insane. I mean, you're talking about $2.5 trillion that's sitting in the Social Security Trust Fund and, you know, probably $500 billion a year that's flowing through. Actually, I don't know what the total amount, the total volume that goes through Social Security, but I think it's several $100 billion. That Wall Street's looking at that going, hey, if we just skimmed 0.1% off the top, well, you know, we could have another 50 or 60 billionaires here on Wall Street. And that's definitely what it is. But see, Congress, the Republican House and the Republican Senate just voted to cut veterans benefits for 70,000 veterans. And it's not even being reported. I mean, this is one of the big problems. I'm looking at MSNBC here now and I'm seeing a Republican strategist talking about Hillary Clinton. Really? I mean, it's anyway.
My point is that the people below the shills, you call them the suckers, the Republican suckers, would actually believe anything that the Republicans say, any excuse they have for doing anything. I mean, these are the people that actually believed in the birther movement. You know, yeah. Obama's not a citizen. The afterbirther movement, okay? And the people that actually believe, I watched John Boehner being asked the question on TV one time. It was, I think it was around 2010 or 2011. Okay. President Obama and the stimulus package had already started turning things around. We're not losing 750,000 jobs a month anymore. Okay. And the reporter asked John Boehner about the stimulus package. And he turns around and says, the stimulus package cost us jobs. It cost us. We lost jobs on account of the stimulus package.
Which is a lie.
Suckers actually, it was an outright, definite lie. It was so obvious that that was not true.
Yeah.
And the Republican suckers just ate it all up. It's
right.
Like they're being.
Well, in part, Andy, that's because the media doesn't say, hey, excuse me, Speaker Boehner, you just lied. I mean, look what Chuck Todd did on Sunday.
Yeah, yeah. And there's another one. Republicans, I live in a right-wing area, okay? And so many of my friends and neighbors actually believe that less people are being insured because of Obamacare, and that there's less insurance, there's less people with health insurance, the number of uninsured increased because of Obamacare. They actually believe that.
Which is also a lie.
Yes, because what is it? 16 million more people have insurance or something?
Yeah, I don't have the number at the tip of my fingers, but it's in that neighborhood. Yeah,
but the people actually believe that, and how to turn that around, I don't know. But going back to the original caller, if Social Security just totally ceased to exist because of something the Republicans did, and it was obvious it was because of what they did, if all veterans, but no more Veterans Administration, just suddenly wiped out. The veterans that voted Republican and the seniors that voted Republican would buy whatever excuse the Republican Party made for that.
Right.
They would just buy it. And I don't get it. I like to say I think for myself, but I look at these people, and does Fox News do your thinking for you?
Yeah.
Tell you what to think?
This is what Dwight Eisenhower wrote to his brother Edgar in 1954, I think it was. It was during his presidency. Yeah, it was November 8th, 1954. And his brother, Edgar, was a fanatic right-winger, and he had been lobbying his brother, the President of the United States, Dwight Eisenhower, to fight Social Security and to fight unions. And Eisenhower replied to him saying, "This is what I mean by my constant insistence on moderation in government. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, abolish unemployment insurance, or eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you will not hear of that party again in our political history. There is a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are H.L. Hunt, you possibly know his background, a few other Texas oil millionaires, and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid." End of quote. This is the president, the Republican president of the United States, writing to his right-wing brother. And but see, the Republican Party has, you know, gone so far from Eisenhower, who ran for re-election in 1956, and the fact that he expanded Social Security and expanded unionization, that I really think that they think that they could get away with it, Andy. I think that they think that they could destroy. I mean, they keep submitting budgets to do this, you know, destroy Social Security, destroy Medicare, destroy public education, and somehow the American people won't realize that the Republicans did it and that this is what the Republicans are all about. I think people are starting to wake up. Andy, thank you for the call. I think people are genuinely starting to wake up. I think Bernie Sanders' candidacy is a reflection of that waking up, the push for Elizabeth Warren, a reflection of that longing for waking up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with your calls after the news at the bottom of the hour. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Today is May 6th, so we don't have today's statistics, but yesterday at the killedbypolice.net website, yesterday a man was killed by police in California, and a man was killed by police in Virginia, a black man in his 40s, and that makes number 400 and number 401 for the year. It's May 6th, and we have killed 401 people. Police in the United States have killed 401 people, according to killedbypolice.net. Whereas in the entire last year in the UK, the police killed 2 people, and in Germany, the police killed nobody. In fact, for most of the last decade, the police killed nobody in most of these northern European countries. But, you know, we got 400. California, Virginia, Washington, Kentucky, New Mexico, these are the recent ones, Utah, Delaware, California, New Jersey, Florida, Michigan, Texas, Georgia, Virginia, Tennessee, on it goes. So, anyway, just let us not forget, we have a problem in this country. And, you know, I had Tommy Christopher on the TV show last night, and he made such an important point. President Obama yesterday made this comment that, you know, basically it's a few bad apples and there's a lot of good cops, and we honor and respect all the hard work they do. And people very often, you know, kind of gratuitously say, oh, it's a tough job, and they're taking their lives in their hands. It's actually, policing in the United States is not even in the top 10 most likely to die on the job jobs. In other words, it's not among the 10 most dangerous jobs in the United States. You will not find policing. But it is, you know, that said, I mean, they run around with guns and they deal with people and circumstances that probably you and I would not want to, and you know, it's a tough job. It's a tough job. But here's the question. If there are so many good cops out there, and the system isn't screwed up somehow, then why is it that we're not hearing from good cops who are pointing out the few bad apples? Why can you not identify the cities in which a police officer came forward and said, you know, during that arrest, I saw this other officer plant evidence? Where are the good cops? I think it's a serious, you know, so how can we say, oh, yeah, you know, the vast majority of police are great, when they're not calling out their brothers and sisters who are corrupt. Another issue for us all. Anyway, Benjamin in Laguna Niguel, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Benjamin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, you mentioned about a progressive party platform. And
right.
I think one of the issues we should bring up is Social Security, but we should do it on a defensive end. I know that there's lots of congressmen and women that want to privatize it, but we should point out to people, like, wait a minute, there's probably lots of your loved ones, family members, and friends that were benefits of this program when they really, really needed it. So if it wasn't such a bad idea back then, why do we need to privatize it right now?
Right.
And once we put these people on the defensive, then we can slowly see their plan unravel, and that's how we get a huge overwhelming consensus to say, no, we still need this more than ever.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, poverty, death from poverty among people, retired people, older people in the United States prior to 1935, prior to the advent of Social Security, was a really serious issue. And, in fact, about half of all people of retirement age in the United States at that point in time were living in deep poverty. And now it's around 10% as a consequence almost exclusively of Social Security and Medicare. And that's a tough one. I think we just need to keep pointing out that Republicans have been fighting Social Security since it was introduced. They have never stopped fighting against it. Ronald Reagan produced a record, a 33-LP, a long speech against Medicare, saying that Medicare, someday we will look back and see that Medicare was the beginning of the end for America when we started going down the road towards Soviet-style socialism. And that's just, you know, that's the Republican position. Good point, Benjamin. Thank you for the call. Patricia in Portage, Wisconsin. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hi. I have a two-part comment to contribute to your various efforts. One is the platform, and if we don't save all other species besides this one species that we spend most of our time talking about, we will not survive. We are warned that we're at tipping points, not just in climate change, but in the destruction of biodiversity. I mean, scientists who are ever conservative are promoting that we probably will have no saltwater fish by 2048. That's what they said about climate change and the Arctic is melting now.
Right.
So the other part is that that should be in the platform. Biodiversity has got to be in the platform. But the second thing is you're having that event in London about extinction.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to bring to the table, because I write a column about this, that the core issue in the United States is that state agencies are funded on killing licenses primarily. And we need to change that to general public funds and a first-time democracy in governing nature.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, I mean, in Wisconsin, you're talking about 400 people being killed by the police in the last 4 months.
Right.
They killed over a million animals in Wisconsin in traps, bludgeoned to death last year.
Oh.
So, you know, another million with guns and crossbows. And
right.
And this suffering goes completely unnoticed. We have to spend a lot more time on the other species on this planet, or we are going to die.
Yeah, I agree, Patricia. We are part of an interconnected web of life, and Cartesian thinking is killing us as fast as anything else. I'm with you. Thank you. Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, hi, Tom. Happy birthday to Sean, and an early happy birthday to you if I'm not old and then forget your birthday. It's in a couple of days.
It's tomorrow. Yeah, thank you, Jesse.
Okay, man. Hey, language.
Yeah.
Bernie really got off to a good start. He says he wants to start a political revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, he's been around the country. He knows what the country is saying. Okay, the Republicans, how do they get to people? They get to use emotion, abortion, race, religion, you name it. Don't give people time to think. Okay, the only thing I would say for Bernie and all progressives is to start using the word civilized. The best thing you could say about these regressive Republicans is they uncivilized.
Yeah.
So Bernie could use a language like, say, where's the beef? Instead of moving to the center, becoming more civilized.
Yeah.
Use term government say, this is not our government. This is the 1%. Use that term. And use bailout. Use where's our bailout? Use a new deal. But the best thing I would say is civilize. Say Bernie could say, hey, we're going to bring Thomas Paine to the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, there you go. I have not been tapped by Bernie's people, and it wouldn't be appropriate in any case as a campaign advisor in any way. So I don't have any input into what they're doing in terms of his running for president. But if I were, I would suggest that the first thing they need to do is some packaging. They need to come up with the equivalent of the Square Deal, the New Deal, the Great Society, the Contract on America. They have to come up with, and which is what Bill de Blasio is doing. He's going to roll one out next week. And Bernie should have he needs a platform that has specific points in it, and then they need to, and it needs to be, you know, in a nice little box with a bow on it. You know, it needs to be all tied up so that you can just deliver it to people and say, here, this is the American way. And, you know, rebooting the American dream, reviving the American dream, restoring the American dream, time for the American dream to come back, whatever. I don't know. It needs to be, you know, thought through and discussed. But I think that we're going to see, I mean, keep in mind, it's a year and a half until the elections. A lot of time for this to happen, a lot of the time for this to come forward. I just read a news story in Politico, that the Sanders for President campaign has just hired the shop that did all the social media outreach for the Obama campaign. So that's like that tells me that all of a sudden Bernie is serious. And not all of a sudden, but I mean, it's for me, that's kind of a tipping point. That's a serious tipping point. So thank you, Jesse, for the call. Jack in Wakanda, Illinois. A minute to the break. Jack, what's up?
I just want to let you know I'm a little bit more hopeful. My father-in-law's staunch Republican, almost, well, I'd say rabid Republican. He's angry about these VA cuts. Angry at Paul Ryan, but not the Republican Party. So he's got another step to go on that. Second piece of hope I'd like to point to is the election in Western Canada of a more progressive labor movement that is aware of climate change and what the tar sands and the oil export pipelines will do to that region.
Yeah.
2 points of hope. Let's keep going.
Yeah, this is a political earthquake just happened in Canada, and I'm trying to find out if it's the leading indicator of a trend or if it's a fluke. And Sean has got some feelers out to some Canadian political experts, you know, political commentators who can give us the straight scoop, or at least the scoop on what happened there from a progressive point of view. So more to come on that, Jack, on this program over the next few days. But thank you for your call. I'm totally with you. And it's wonderful to hear about your father or father-in-law, I forget who it was, who is, you know, people are waking up. And yeah, at first they'll blame Scott Ryan or Scott Walker or Paul Ryan, and then they'll say, but wait a minute, don't all the Republicans want to do this? Don't they, all the Republicans? I mean, all they want to help is the billionaires.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Michelle in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Michelle, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'll go through some things real quick, running out of time. First of all, real quickly, to answer your question, where are the good cops? There are no protections for whistleblowers, and if you want to blow the whistle, you might as well kiss your life goodbye. I've done it myself. You will not only be blacklisted in that profession, you're likely to be blacklisted across the board. Two, what I really called about, to go back to Eisenhower, as a matter of fact, and Reaganomics, my dad was born in 1945. He's been a lifelong Democrat, and he's always gone by the mantra, you know, the Republicans like to keep you broke but not bankrupt. And I've had to explain to him, but Dad, what's happened since Reaganomics is that they decided to push it to the next level.
All right.
And see if we can get away with bankrupt, and they have for the past 30 years.
About $1 trillion in student debt? You know,
Well, the housing market, the bubble that collapsed in 2008, that was the first wake-up call. And you're absolutely right. When this student debt bubble breaks, you talk about a wake-up call. that, I think, is going to be the final straw. And it's, yeah, we're having to cycle through two generations to get to that point. And lastly, real quick, as far as a tagline or 13 points or a bumper sticker, something along the lines of, for Democrats, ethical apathy is un-American.
That's nice. Ethical apathy is un-American. I'm thinking just a new deal would be, you know, it's evoking the new deal. Although I don't know if, you know, most people under 40 or 50 even know what the new deal is, because I don't think they teach that stuff in schools anymore. But excellent.
Well,
points.
Yeah, that's actually another facet of the problem of,
yes,
of where big money has infiltrated. You know, I remember all the discussions about, oh my goodness, Obama's going to instill indoctrination. Are you kidding me? Seriously? Talk about the pot calling the kettle. Well, that's a bad pun. But that's not even taught in schools anymore. Nobody knows what this is.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems, to going back to some of these old phrases, old taglines. Younger people just don't know what it is.
Right, and they don't know the history of labor, and therefore they think, oh, you know, so the unions get whacked, so what? And they don't realize what life in America was like before we had unions. And it was hellish for working people. So
exactly, and if you have no point of reference, and your audience has no point of reference, you can't hang your hat on that. Your message will not get through.
This is why it's
something that is a point of reference.
Yeah, and this is why it's so important for people who are old enough to remember what America was like before Reaganomics really took hold, who can, you know, remember the United States in the 60s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, even the 80s. I mean, it wasn't until the 90s that we really started seeing the bubbles emerging really rapidly, with the dot-com bubble, the first one, that were the consequence of the Reagan tax cuts. You always see giant bubbles emerge when there's, you know, huge tax cuts on rich people, because they got to put their money someplace, and wherever they put it, it starts creating bubbles. And just it's just exactly the same way it happened in 1921. And so the generation that remembers that, those of us old enough to remember how America was, have an obligation to educate and inform young people about that, because they have no memory of it. And you're not seeing it on TV. It's not, you know, it's the Beaver Cleaver shows are gone. You know, it's just, it's not there anymore. Michelle, thank you for the call. There's no education. There's no background. There's no, as Michelle correctly said, context. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And a note from Shano to Sean. Krista Freeland, who wrote Plutocrats, is now a member of the Canadian Parliament and would be a really cool guest if she's doing media. Just an FYI. Dave in L.A. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Last hour, you brought up several points that followed a particular rabbit hole I went down over the course of the last week. But, I'd like to make a couple of quick ones here, and I'll lead to my major point. You mentioned about Citadel and the hedge fund. You know, of course, that that's where Ben Bernanke went. That's the revolving door.
I mentioned that.
Through.
Yeah. He just got a job.
Bill Ackman, he's an activist investor. He's a short player. He goes out and destroys companies, asset strips them, and makes his money. Right now, he's famous for Herbalife. He's in a big war with them that's hit the news.
Hmm.
But there's an article on Zero Hedge Fund that came up last week that's a particular interest. It's called The Financial Markets Now Control Everything. And it's a short article, and it gives us history, but more importantly, it led me to a documentary done in 1999 by Adam Curtis, a guy who did Century of Self and The Power of Nightmares.
Right.
And it's about
for the BBC.
It's about the UK. Someone traveling to the UK might be of interest to this. But it's called the Mayfair Set. It's a four-part series that goes back to the history of how the politicians were taken over control by the financial markets. And it deals primarily with the UK, but it mentions a lot that happened in the U.S., Reaganomics, particularly.
Well, Thatcher took over 2 years in the U.K., 2 years before Reagan, and Jimmy Carter was even starting to adopt some of her policies.
It started in the 50s.
Yeah.
It started in the 1950s. It was very enlightening. Sterling, a guy by the name of Sterling, and Larry Goldsmith were primary movers, and they ended up turning against what they had created.
Right.
But it's very excellent documentary. Like I say, four parts. And it takes you through, brings you back up to Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky. And it's the same technique, this asset stripping, and how they convinced everyone that the shareholders were the true owners of the company,
right,
which had never been done before.
Right.
They were investors. And you still hear this today. It's so relevant today. That's why the article was written, that of what's going on now and how they're taking control and convincing the poor schmuck that he owns 100 shares that's in his best interest,
right,
to destroy these companies. They've even used the pension funds of the companies themselves, first as tools, and then the pension funds started doing it themselves, destroying the very company that the pension fund came out of.
Right.
Because their charter was to the shares of the pension, not to the company.
Right.
And they could do this.
Yeah, we dropped through the rabbit hole during the 8 years that Ronald Reagan was president, and we haven't come back out of it yet. And Adam Curtis does absolutely brilliant work. I haven't seen that series. I've seen most of his other series. The Power of Nightmares was astonishing. I'll have to look for it. Dave, thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. Eric in Portland. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Happy birthday to you and Sean. I know yours is tomorrow.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a suggestion that if the small chance that Bernie Sanders doesn't get in, would you think he would be considered as a vice president to Hillary Clinton?
I have no idea. My guess is that I think it's a virtual certainty that she will get a man, because two women on a ticket right now, there's so much misogyny in this country, it would be very difficult to sell, particularly in the South. But whether that man would be Bernie or not, I'm guessing that, you know, she's perceived as a Northeast liberal, even though she's originally from Arkansas. Actually, I think she's originally from Chicago. And Bernie's perceived as a Northeast liberal. So my guess is that she will probably reach out for somebody from the Southwest or the West. But I don't have a clue, Eric. I don't have a clue.
Okay.
But it's an interesting question. And I don't know if Bernie would want the job either, frankly. But who knows? Thank you for the call. Alice in Chicago. Hey, Alice, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to bring up something that I have thought about for a while. You know, in Australia, there's mandatory voting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the ways to take the spotlight off of the moneyed interests in Congress is to have mandatory voting. Because if they had mandatory voting, every American who is a registered and legitimate voter must vote, then the people in Congress, instead of playing to special interests, who would give them money and keep them in office, they would have to, the representatives would have to play to the center and the majority of Americans, because those are the people who then would be voting their interests. For instance, they always say that, I think they say only 32% of Americans voted last time or something
right.
like that.
Yeah.
And also that Americans in general all agree on a number of things like gun control, and that that millionaires should pay more, and that we should pay more attention to the environment, and this whole array of things that most Americans agree with. But because congressmen, senators and representatives, and even the president, they try to please the special interests who give them money to run, then the general public's opinion doesn't count at all.
Right.
But if it was mandatory voting and you had to vote, people would start thinking about what they really wanted and who represented what they really wanted.
Right. We're not going to get mandatory voting in the United States, though, Alice. In fact, I'm guessing the Supreme Court would strike it down as unconstitutional. So what's a middle ground? I think automatic voter registration is an easy one, right? If you're a citizen, you're automatically registered to vote.
Yeah. It
would have to be state by state. Alice, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but thank you for the call. It's a great suggestion. The devil's in the details, as they say. Thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Do something. Go over to BernieSanders.com or MoveToAmend.org or PDAmerica.org or some, one of these progressive groups and say, yeah, I will pitch in. Tag. You're It. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.